From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Biden met with leaders of Sweden and Finland at the White House this morning to talk about their efforts to join the NATO military alliance. The move would end both countries' long-standing neutrality. Biden called it momentous and said NATO is growing stronger in the face of Russian aggression in Ukraine.
New members joining NATO is not a threat to any nation. It never has been. NATO's purpose is to defend against aggression. That's its purpose, to defend.
That's President Biden. NPR's Anya Kamenetz joins us now from Dnipro, Ukraine. Hi, Anya.
Hello, Lisa.
The war is obviously changing geopolitical alliances and rapidly, with Sweden and Finland breaking their neutrality. Would you bring us up to date on just what's happening on the ground now in Ukraine?
Sure. So, you know, there have been sort of steady gains by Ukraine, for example, liberation of the city of Kharkiv. We've seen the U.S. embassy reopening and a new ambassador confirmed. And so that's sort of a sign of normalcy in the capital. But there's still bombardments, there's still skirmishes and fighting, in fact, in many occupied territories, especially in the east of the country.
And what is happening specifically with the ongoing evacuation of the steel plant, where there have been many Ukrainians who have attempted to hide out?
So Azovstal in Mariupol is really something that has become like a modern day battle of Thermopylae, as my colleague Joanna Kakissis, who's been covering this, likes to say. Things have gotten a little murky with this in the last few days. Less than 200 Ukrainian soldiers who had been making kind of a last stand within the steel plant were ordered to surrender. They were bused to Russian-controlled territories. There was talk of a prisoner swap from there, but now Russian media reports that instead these soldiers may be put on trial. The International Red Cross is registering the evacuees as prisoners of war, which I guess is one indication that the world is going to continue to be watching Azovstal and, of course, Mariupol.
And you mentioned trials of Ukrainian soldiers. There is a trial going on now, the first war crimes trial of a Russian soldier. Tell us what's happening there.
Right. So my colleague Greg Myrie has been covering this in Kyiv. This is a 21-year-old soldier who, in the first days of the war, has now admitted in court that he shot and killed a 62-year-old civilian. And in fact, in court, he asked the man's widow for forgiveness. This 21-year-old is facing up to life in prison.
And it was a dramatic scene when she actually questioned him and said, "What was it like when you pulled the trigger on my husband?" Are we likely to see more of these prosecutions?
You know, the Ukrainian prosecutor general said she's investigating more than 11,000 alleged war crimes. This is a little bit unusual since obviously hostilities are continuing. But, you know, advocates are saying they don't want these crimes to go unnoticed, undocumented while they're still fresh. I spoke to Oleksandra Matvichuk. She's a human rights lawyer, the head of the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine, which is monitoring this war crimes trial and also documenting war crimes throughout the country. And this is a really experienced human rights lawyer with many years of experience documenting war crimes. And personally, she told me this has been a very difficult time for her because she's overwhelmed by the scale and the brutality. We're talking about kidnappings, rapes, torture, extrajudicial killings. And she said that everything we've seen so far is only the tip of the iceberg.
You are in Dnipro now, which is the fourth largest city in Ukraine. It's to the southeast of the capital, Kyiv, and closer to the front lines. What are you seeing?
Right. So I visited a refugee center today, which is a first stop typically for up to 1,000 people a day, women and children. And I think what really surprised me is that they said that the flow of displaced people out of occupied territories really has not slowed down. There are people evacuating now who may have spent 6 weeks or more under constant shelling. There's convoys of supplies going back out into Russian-controlled territories. And it's a real contrast with the capital where I just left. You know, I visited there a mall that was full of bus designer stores, a famous restaurant that had reopened. And here the war just seems much more ongoing and present in people's lives.
There is a serious concern. It came up at the United Nations again yesterday about what's happening with food supplies. The UN has warned Russia's invasion of Ukraine could soon cause a massive food crisis that could go on for years. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so this is really the looming aspect of this conflict that out of everything that's happening, maybe has the most potential to disrupt lives around the world. Right now, you know, Ukraine, we've known it as the breadbasket of Europe. But right now within the country, about one in three households are food insecure. There's the current planting and harvest season where crop yields could be down by at least 20% because they're interrupting that cycle of planting and harvesting. And then there's the blockade in the Black Sea. So that's choking off grain exports to countries that are in dire need of them for a variety of reasons, like Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, as well as in Africa. This in turn could tip millions more people around the world into famine. As we see that naval blockade by the Russians, they've also reportedly stolen 400,000 tons of that Ukrainian grain from various regions. And there's been at least one shipment was tracked to a port in Syria. I heard about this personally today. A woman who escaped from a region that's still under attack told me that the people in her town are too afraid to go out and plant their vegetable gardens. It's vegetable planting time. Lots of people in Ukraine are still dependent on kind of backyard gardening. And she said, you know, you're going to find Russian shells instead of seeds in those gardens.
Thank you for keeping an eye on all of this for us. NPR's Anya Kamenets in Dnipro, Ukraine. Anya, thank you.
Thank you.
The 18-year-old man accused of opening fire and killing 10 people and wounding three others in a grocery store in Buffalo, New York on Saturday appeared in court today. The suspect, who was white, pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder charges at his arraignment Saturday. He's accused of targeting a store in a black neighborhood, and federal officials are investigating the shooting as a possible hate crime. NPR's Cheryl Corley is in Buffalo, and Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Oh, of course.
What happened in the courtroom today?
Well, it was a very brief gathering. The prosecution team was the first in court, three attorneys. And then the defense team came in, three attorneys there as well, with the 18-year-old suspect following. He was in an orange jumpsuit. He wore a face mask. There were also family members of some of the victims in the courtroom as well. And then the prosecution team presented an affidavit to the court, which indicated that a grand jury had voted for an indictment against the suspect and a date was set for the next hearing. It all happened very fast. The meeting adjourned. And as the suspect was leaving, going back to the jail lockup, a woman in the audience yelled, "Hey, you're a coward."
Wow. Well, the hearing, so the first step in the prosecution for this crime, what comes next?
Well, grand jury investigations are secret, but what typically happens is that you have this group of 23 people. They listen to information about an alleged crime, and then they take a vote saying whether or not evidence is sufficient and a case should be held for a trial. And that's what happened in this case. The grand jury investigation, though, is not over. It's not complete. Once it begins, you have about 45 days to come to a decision, so the clock is ticking. So at this time, the suspect remains charged with one count of murder in the first degree, and we may know more on June 9th. And if an indictment is announced then, the suspect would go through another arraignment where he would plead that is either guilty or not guilty, and a trial date could be set. And just a reminder, Anthony, that it was just hours after he surrendered to police last Saturday that prosecutors charged him with that first-degree murder charge, and that's when he did plead not guilty.
So this shooting is also being investigated as a hate crime, and officials are considering a terrorism charge. Can you tell us more about the investigations and the other charges that the suspect may end up facing?
Yeah, some of that will come from the grand jury, and the Buffalo police commissioner indicated earlier this week that the mass shooting was what he considered a racist hate crime and that it would be prosecuted as a hate crime and that evidence would support that. The district attorney also indicated that what is happening now is a deeper investigation where they're just going to try to speak with just about anyone that the suspect knew, get background information about him in order to figure out his intent, why he did this, which would, of course, be key to a trial. And there's also a federal investigation. So these kind of two parallel investigations going on with the FBI looking at the massacre at the supermarket as both a hate crime and a racially motivated violent extreme extremism. Of course, among the 13 people who were killed or injured, 11 of them were African-American and two of them were white.
Right. And of course, this is a community that is both outraged, understandably so, and in mourning. I'm wondering what you're hearing from the community. How are people coping with this loss?
Well, as you can imagine, there's a lot of grief, a lot of anger. There's an avalanche of support, though, for the families of victims and other folks who were just impacted by the shooting. Donations have come in. There are food banks, food distribution sites, since the grocery store where the shooting occurred is still a crime scene that's being processed. That store has also set up a shuttle to transport shoppers to its other stores. There have been prayer vigils. A big one is planned for this evening. And people have just come together in a sense of unity to overcome what's happened here in Buffalo. The first funeral is going to be held tomorrow.
All right. Well, that's NPR national correspondent Cheryl Corley reporting in Buffalo from Buffalo. Cheryl, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Earlier this week, we learned that the Tops Friendly Market in Buffalo, where that fatal mass shooting took place, was a supermarket that black residents of the neighborhood had fought for years to get. The store is now closed while authorities complete their investigation, and that leaves residents back to traveling miles for basic necessities. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates there are more than 65,000 so-called food deserts across the U.S., places where residents don't have convenient access to fresh foods. Here and Now's Tanya Mosley has been reporting on food deserts and recently spent time in South Central Los Angeles, where, according to the nonprofit Story Maps, there are only 7 grocery stores for more than 750,000 residents. In this conversation from the podcast Truth Be Told, Tanya spoke about food access with the creator of an organization called Feed Our Soul.
Urban farmer Adrian Wilson studied restaurant hospitality and food systems at Georgetown University. And during her studies, she got to thinking about access to food where she grew up in South Central LA. She began thinking, what are the ways she could build a system where people didn't have to travel miles for basic necessities like fruits and vegetables? She created Feed Our Soul, a nonprofit organization that builds hydroponic farms and schools across LA. We met up at the Crenshaw Farmers Market, also in South Central, where Wilson does cooking demonstrations using fresh ingredients to show young people how to prepare their own meals. She calls this work she does restorative.
So restorative to me means the same thing that how you think about with your body or with the earth. You know, it's the kind of this life-death life cycle that goes on that happens in nature. And so when you want to restore something, it means that it's something is coming to an end, but there are still pieces that you can use in order to rebuild that foundation. And so restorative in terms of Feed Our Soul, is our goal is to make sure that we create a new world where we do have some of the great things that we love and enjoy, but also kind of just reimagining what our food system looks like. What does it look like to eat healthy, fresh produce that grows from the ground and that we grow ourselves?
I've heard you use the term, I think we all know or understand, a majority of us, what a food desert is, the lack of ability within your community to find nourishing food. But I've also heard you talk about food swamps. What is a food swamp?
So a food swamp is where you are oversaturated with processed foods, right? So those usually go hand in hand. If you don't have natural foods, you know, or access to natural foods or grocery stores in that area, you probably have a lot of McDonald's, Taco Bell, KFC, Popeyes.
Yeah, that's how I grew up.
Right, all around you. And that's all you know. That's all you know is going to the bodega to get, you know, bacon, egg, and cheese, you know, and then the next day maybe getting some French fries and some wings. If that is all you know and you have zero access to fresh food, like it will never be a part of your life. And so when you do see it so accessible in a hydroponic farm or in, you know, a farmer's market, it can seem so foreign to you. And then it's very difficult to break that cycle. I commend anyone who tries to do it, because I had to do it myself. You know, I had to learn how to, you know, really be conscious about where my food is coming from, and making sure that I'm putting fresh and healthy things into my body.
So you went to Georgetown,
yes,
and studied hospitality,
yes,
but then that got you really interested in food systems.
Yes. I really got into it when I was trying to understand the cost of restaurants, because that was my dream. I wanted to open my own restaurant, and still do. But I was like, well, why does this food cost so much money? I'm like, I don't understand why mint costs $10 for 3 ounces. I don't understand. It just didn't compute in my mind. I was like, if this stuff comes from the ground, why am I charging so much? And it's because of cost of delivery, right? Transportation. It's cost of someone else growing it for you. It's cost of it making it into your ecosystem, and then you have to use it properly. And because it has a shelf life, right? So all those things come into effect when you think about our food ecosystem. And I was just like, this is wrong. When you think about slaves, and you think about our history as Black people, you know, we brought seeds back from the motherland to grow so that we can have familiarity, you know, things that connect us back to our home. And so that was just, I was just like, we have to fix this. And especially because it affects Black people so directly. It affects us so directly. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and I, you know, was fortunate enough to be able to go to a school in the West Side.
For those who aren't from LA, because the West Side is more affluent.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they have more grocery stores.
Yeah.
You know, they have all the Whole Foods. They have the good produce. And when I not only, and I saw it here, but it didn't compute in my mind, you know, like when I'm like, oh yeah, my dad's like, oh, I got to get up and go to the store at 7 o'clock in the morning, but I have to drive all the way to Westchester. And I just didn't think about it. But looking back, I'm like, he shouldn't have had to do that. We all should never have to do that.
Was this something that you understood from the start, to meet people where they are, or was this a process through your work that you realized? Yeah.
Absolutely a process through my work. Not everybody understands that they live in a food desert or in a food swamp. They don't even, it's not even in their awareness, right? They're just like, this is the food that I have. I only have $4 and I have to feed 3 mouths. How can I feed my children,
right?
Right?
And it's legitimate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And some people have those lives where they are working 2-3 jobs just so that they can get their food stamps. And what can you get on food stamps? Not much, because I've been on them and I know you can't get much. So it's like, how do we fix it so that people can have access to the food so that it doesn't have to be a strain?
What does it mean to decolonize our connection, or maybe our food systems? What does that mean for you?
Oof, that is a good question. To decolonize the food system would be, I kind of see it in two prongs. I see it as first to take back a little bit of the consumerism, right? You know, really being conscious of where your dollars are going, like supporting local farmers markets or supporting local businesses. And I think it also has an unlearning with your habits and our connection with agriculture, right? I think that we have to not look at it as a bad thing, that we are do come from farmers. You know, we as slaves and Black people, we've farmed cotton, right? We farmed tobacco, right? We farmed these things that are now, you know, staples and necessities in our life. And I know that it is tied to such a hurtful history, but there is beauty in it as well.
I mean, I just had a little bit of an epiphany, like maybe this moment is such an important one because we're far enough away to be able to connect to those good things about our people who were enslaved, but we have the agency to take those beautiful things and make something even more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is our duty, right? For the future generations. I feel like we are in such a prime space for us to unlearn all the things that we were taught, right? And choosing to do something that benefits us directly. And yes, it can eventually benefit the world, but they're not looking out for us, so we got to look out for ourselves. And how do we do that? And especially in the food industry, in the food space, it is taking it back. And it's understanding that you can control a tiny little plot of land, can produce so much for you and your families and for your children. And it's something to do, something to pull you away from the electronics, something to get you outside, breathe some fresh air.
When I was a little girl, for a moment, we had a garden in the back, and we were actually growing all types of things, including corn stalks. And we had like 4 or 5 corn stalks in the city of Detroit.
Yes.
But I was so proud of that thing.
Exactly.
I mean,
so proud.
Yes.
You're like, I don't know what I can bring, but I got corn.
Right.
You know? And that's how it used to be. That's the whole idea of a potluck, right? You know, that farmer brings corn, you bring tomatoes, you bring lettuce, you bring potatoes. Let's all bring all of our abundance together and we all can have a feast, right? But it takes that community of all of us working together. So that's why it's little steps. It's little steps, little seeds that you're planting all around. And eventually, we will grow and become a beautiful tree.
That was my conversation with urban farmer Adrian Wilson, founder of the organization Feed Our Soul in Los Angeles. And you can hear our entire conversation on my podcast, Truth Be Told, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're invested in the stock market, well, cover your eyes. Don't look. Go back to bed. Put a pillow over your head because it was a calamity on Wall Street yesterday. How bad was it? Well, the tech-heavy NASDAQ fell 5%, nearly 5%. Two of the major indexes had their worst performance since the early days of the pandemic in 2020. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi is with us now. Ali, good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
So stocks have been falling for weeks, but yesterday was really rough. What's going on?
Well, look, it's a combination of things, mostly inflation, but real fears of a recession and a little more COVID. I think the best way to tell the story is Target Corporation, right? Which Target lost more than a quarter of its value just on Wednesday, yesterday, and it's down further today. It's down 35% for the year. Why is that? Because they came out and said a bunch of things are going on. They're saying that supply chain costs are causing prices to go up. Inflationary pressures are cutting into its profits because it's paying more for fuel and for energy, and that customers are buying fewer of the high-end, the high-margin items like kitchen appliances, televisions, furniture. Well, that everybody else sort of saw the same thing. Walmart stocks tumbled. They said the same thing. Amazon, Best Buy, Costco. Everybody is realizing that the consumer is retrenching a little bit, and of course, our economy is based upon consumer confidence and consumer spending. So that has had a ripple effect through the market. It's been going on for a few weeks now,
right?
But Target sort of crystallizes the fact that something bad might be on the horizon.
Oh boy! So we always like to point out that the stock market is not the economy. It's not the economy, but clearly investors are worried about stuff. So it sounds like you're saying that to a certain extent, these plunging markets really reflect broader challenges in the economy, right?
Yeah. So let me tell you, you're right to point that out. It's not the economy. Interest rates are up, right? A mortgage rate is double what it was in December, but it's still 6%. There's nothing you know, critical about a 6% 30-year mortgage. It's just more expensive than a 3% one. Unemployment remains low. Wages remain high. Oil is expensive at $100 a barrel, but it was $140 a barrel, you know, some time ago. So it's not the whole market, but it is the sentiment of the economy right now. The market takes the temperature of the economy. And right now, investors are saying, it looks risky. It looks cloudy out there. I can't tell what's in the distance. So I'm going to take my money out of the market. At least professional investors are saying that. And regular investors, like the people who are listening to us who have 401ks or IRAs, are getting hit by that because they don't tend to day trade, but the market's going down around them. And that's what it is. So it's not the economy, but it's a temperature gauge, basically.
Right. What about the Fed's effort to cool inflation and slow this economy down? Are they going to be able to do that, pushing interest rates up? Is that going to work? Causing a recession, by the way.
And that's the key part of the question. Yes, they can definitely calm inflation down by putting interest rates up. They did it by half a percentage point. They're going to do it again, and they may do it, you know, more times this year. That'll definitely, at some point, slow the economy down. The problem is it's not a science. It's an art. So if you do it enough to temper inflation, you might actually just stop people from spending money for a while. That triggers a recession. That's why solving for inflation, you know, for years when we didn't have inflation, the Fed would always talk about it. And people said, why are we worried about this? Right. We don't have inflation. When it sneaks up on you, it happens fast and it's very hard to fight.
Ali Velshi, thanks so much. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
This week, the winner of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest was announced, and from thousands of entries, this song triumphed.
Cuando miro afuera, cuando miro adentro, cuando miro afuera otra vez. De la periferia hasta el mero centro, siempre soy testigo y juez.
This is Milonga Occidental, performed by Boston musician Elisa Amador. For Elisa, music has been a lifelong family affair. Her parents, Rosie and Brian Amador, are founders of the musical group Soli Canto, which for over a quarter of a century has thrilled audiences with soulful ballads and lively dance rhythms.
Lisa.
Last year, Soli Canto celebrated its 25th anniversary with a live album En Vivo en Familia, or Live in the Family. It was then that Elisa Amador and her mom, Rosie, talked to us about their musical family. Appropriately, our interview aired just before Mother's Day.
Back when Elisa and her twin were 7, we recorded a children's album together.
We were the built-in backup
that's
singers.
Right.
Free child labor.
That's right.
Family business.
But here's the thing. Fun. They took off musically on their own. Elisa started composing at age 15 and performing. Mm-hmm. And we made this album because she has one foot out the door already. Had it not been for the pandemic, she would be on the road constantly. And we really wanted to create something with her that included all of the songs that she had been singing with us for some time. And then we finally did it. So it's a huge celebration of our togetherness as a family. And in a way, it's also a launching of Elisa into her own path.
And I want to talk about that, Elisa, with you, because you're drawing a lot of attention on the indie music scene. And your voice, Elisa, is so beautiful, and it's different from your mom's.
You.
And I wonder, let's hear a little bit right now of one of the songs on the album that you wrote, Elisa, Home Again.
I made myself some tea, and I sat upon the rug, braided years before I was. Twinkle in your eye, under me, holding all of the dust and the stories of my youth, my new
England. Lisa, what's the inspiration for the song?
I wrote this song as I was packing up my college dorm room, preparing to move in with my family for the first time as a young adult. At first, it just seemed like a little portrait of me moving out. And then that line came, this rug that was braided years before, I was a twinkle in your eye. And my parents always say that, especially when I was younger. They said, oh, when we first started Sol y Canto, when you were a twinkle in our eye and we toured here and there. And so that came, it had been floating around, I guess, in my memory. And it came out in that moment as I prepared to move back home, but as a young adult this time, and just a really poignant time. And it felt really right to put that on the album and for them to learn how to sing it with me.
So what do you say I come home again and I leave these old books behind? Can't take back the miles that have kept me away, so I'll thank them for shaping my mind.
And I wonder what it was like, Rosie, for you as Elisa's mom to be learning a song that your daughter wrote and singing along with her.
That's a great question, Lisa. Because Elisa has been singing and composing for so long and I've fallen in love with so many of her songs, when she invited us to sing along, I just felt so honored and excited, because there's nothing more exciting than being able to sing on your daughter's song, just as she has accompanied us on so many songs for so many years. So kind of, you know, what goes around comes around.
And this takes us to the song Amaras. This was written by Brian, your husband, Rosie, and your father, Elisa. Yes. Let's hear a bit of it.
O tal vez no, tal vez no, o tal vez no llegues a encontrar tu alma gemela.
No. O tal vez no,
tal vez tu media naranja resulte
tal
limón.
Vez no.
This is a song in the rhythm of bolero, Cuban bolero, that Brian wrote for our twins. Amarás means you will love. And the verse, one of the important verses, says you will love and the object of your love won't always deserve it. You'll cry. And maybe from your tears will spring a new enchantment. Or maybe not. Maybe.
Or maybe, you didn't, I was going to say the next line, or maybe your better half turns out to be a lemon.
That's right. You like got
his,
it.
I like his realism. And singing together like this, what is it like now versus what it was like before, Elisa, before you broke out on your own?
It's quite surreal.
It is.
I have to say, having been born into this band and this lifestyle, knowing every nuance of what happens behind the stage and every minute of the work that my parents put into creating a performance and really understanding the ins and outs of being a musician and crafting a concert. And they really taught me everything I know. So to come back after college and to create this album together where we're really both coming at it as full people.
That's
and
it.
Approaching the music with all of our heart. It's just really beautiful, and I'm so grateful it was recorded.
You guys are mother and daughter. Don't you ever argue?
Oh, yes.
Never.
What?
Jamás.
See, we've already argued on this interview. We're already disagreeing. No, we drive each other crazy sometimes.
Sometimes. But not often, I have to say.
No.
We're both pretty open-hearted and good communicators, and we know that to solve any problem, you just have to be real.
Yeah,
you
and yell at each other a little.
Every now and then.
And then hug.
Exacto.
But when you're working together, I mean, are you ever tempted, Elisa, to actually say to your incredibly proficient mother, I'd rather have you sing it this way? Or same thing with Rosie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever say, yes, darling, that's beautiful, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
We have very open discussions about arrangements.
When you're in a band together, you just have to get comfortable with that, or else you would never get through a rehearsal.
I wonder if you can give us an example of how you find a harmony that works in your individual styles. Is there something you could just give us 30 seconds of?
Let's see. Can we think of something?
Tonada.
Tonada, in which we sing in our individual styles?
Tonada de luna llena.
Yeah?
And I know Brian is nearby.
Shall I put the headphone on him?
Just for a sec, yeah.
Hello.
Hey, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing?
It's so nice to talk to you. Congratulations on the 25 years and on the album. I'm just wondering if you can direct your daughter and your wife in a bit of harmony, and you can even join it, that your family is so fond of and does so beautifully.
Okay. Well, let me get a note and we'll try that.
Okay. We'll just do a little snippet here, right? Okay.
Yep.
Yo vine una garza pobre dándole combate al río. Así es como se enamora tu corazón con el mío. Yo vine una garza pobre dándole combate a un río. Así es como se enamora. Así es como se enamora. Tu corazón con el mío, tu corazón con el mío.
That was amazing.
Oh, good. We were going to keep going and I had to decrescendo us.
Oh, no, we'll have to save the crescendo. I just want to thank all of you, the three of you, and wish you, Rosie, a happy Mother's Day.
Thank
I don't know,
you.
Elisa, are you a mother?
Not no. yet, but I do want to say to my mom, thank you so Aww. Much for being my mother, for raising me, and Aww. For teaching me how to just completely give myself to this craft, and for supporting me through it all. You've taught
well,
me so much just by
so
being.
So proud of you and so happy for you. Thank
all
you
right.
so
well,
much for
luck.
Having
Congratulations.
Us, Lisa.
Congratulations. Happy
thank
Mother's
you.
Day.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Elisa and Rosie Amador speaking with us last May. For more about Soli Canto and to see Elisa's Tiny Desk winning video, go to hereandnow.org.
Is an elephant a person? For many, of course, the answer is a clear no. But many animal rights advocates believe that animals, including elephants, should receive legal protection similar to humans. In a trial now underway in the New York Court of Appeals, advocates are suing on behalf of Miss Happy, a 51-year-old elephant. They're arguing for her personhood and want her freed from the Bronx Zoo and transferred to an animal sanctuary. Here to discuss this case and its implications is author and Harvard historian Jill Lepore. Jill, good to be with you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Happy the Elephant and this specific case, which is brought by the Florida-based Non-Human Rights Project. This group wants basically a court to grant personhood to this elephant.
So Happy was born in the wild in Thailand and was captured as a baby. She was less than a year old and imported to the United States with a bunch of other baby elephants. They were named after the Seven Dwarfs. They were brought to the U.S. by Lion Country Safari, which was a sort of kind of Busch Garden / Disney World animal adventure site. And as they aged, they were moved around. And in 1977, she and Grumpy, one of the other so-called Seven Dwarfs, were brought to the Bronx Zoo. But the Non-Human Rights Project chose Happy as the client in this case to try to advance the argument for personhood. They chose Happy in particular because she is alone. There's another elephant at the zoo, but they are separated. And she's in what is by now, these standards, quite a small enclosure. And also because Happy was the first elephant to pass a cognition test known as the mirror self-recognition test. She can look into a mirror and it can be proven that she knows that she's looking at herself. There's like a lot of popular sentiment around the suffering of elephants because of the ways in which elephants are social and tender and have memories and attachments and abilities to communicate.
Right, right. Jill, I know that you visited Happy. What was your impression about her condition? And what does the Bronx Zoo say about Happy's care?
She's in a very small enclosure. Elephants are extremely social. She is alone. She has a number of indicators of stress, the way she sort of shifts her feet, the way she sways, this kinds of restlessness. But, you know, I'm no expert there. And the Bronx Zoo has depositions of the veterinarians who have treated her. They say the keepers know what's best for her. The curator of the zoo, the director of the zoo say that Happy doesn't get along with other elephants. And my approach in considering the case really has been essentially as a biographer. I went and did a kind of deep investigation of the story of Happy's life and what has happened to her at each stage of her life. what it was like when she was captured, what those conditions were, who was doing the capturing in Thailand at the time, what the mode of transportation was, how the will of baby elephants is broken, what it means to be separated from your mother as a baby elephant. Elephants, female elephants never leave their mothers their whole lives. Mm. So to be taken from your mother at age one, probably having seen your mother killed. So really, her life story is a story of tremendous tragedy and loss and violence and deprivation. That's the condition of most elephants in most zoos. It is, the Bronx Zoo is a very good and responsible zoo. I think people who make the argument that Happy doesn't belong there would also say that no elephant belongs in a zoo.
Right.
But in fact, the claim that Happy is a person is a really important legal argument that needs to be taken seriously regarding, is there any way, any set of legal strategies that could possibly halt mass extinction and global climate change by way of not just giving humans protections from the decay of their environment, but actually granting rights to the natural world. And that, to me, is what the story really is about and why it is so important.
Hmm. One more question, because I'm so intrigued by this detail. Some legal scholars have pointed out an important connection between this case, a habeas corpus case arguing for the personhood of an elephant, and habeas corpus cases filed a long time ago on behalf of enslaved people. Can you explain that connection?
Yeah, so habeas cases or freedom suits were a hugely important political tool during the abolitionist movement and the anti-slavery movement in the 18th century. People held in bondage filed habeas cases and said, we are unlawfully held as prisoners. And it was a habeas case that ended slavery in England in the 1770s in a ruling in an English court that is much cited by the Non-Human Rights Project. And it was, I will tell you, haunting to be in Albany in this courthouse hearing these arguments in a building where the flags on the roof were at half-mast because of the massacre in Buffalo by white supremacists who deny basic rights to people who aren't white. So the rights that humans have here and certainly around the world are not well defended or universally enforced. So I think there are plenty of critics who would find it hard to imagine making this move with so many humans denied their full and equal rights.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating story. That's author and Harvard historian Jill Lepore talking about the case of Happy the Elephant and whether she should be granted personhood. Jill Lepore, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.